disturbing moment just a few minutes ago. I go to get in, come in the front door, and my card's not working. Tom, did you have anything to do with my card being, like, turned off or me being let go and no one telling me?
I didn't think you were coming in today, John.
Gotcha.
I think it was operator error.
Me rubbing my butt up against the door for the thing to open up. That's the way I roll. All right, let's see. Seattle looks to Minneapolis for help when it comes to solving the problems of prolific offenders. And they had a nice little seminar of some sort. They had some pretty dramatic lighting behind them on that beautiful brick wall. Did you watch it, Tom?
No.
No. Would you do read the thing?
Yeah. Okay. Like I'm supposed to.
Oh, well, here's Gary Horker doing all the hard work.
Hey, I don't want to lie. This isn't, maybe not for Seattle, but it is working for us.
This group dramatically improved the safety of downtown Minneapolis over the last 9 years. Their top strategy, keeping up with the city's repeat offenders from the streets to homeless camps.
A lot of times the outreach workers already know them.
But Assistant Minneapolis Police Chief Mike Yost said his department strictly enforces drug dealing. He said he was shocked seeing all the open-air drug dealing here on 3rd Avenue.
I don't see that same level in Minneapolis, that openness. Where they weren't trying to hide it at all.
And his jaw dropped. I mean, we walked by open narcotics dealing where I could see the product, we could see the money, and he was floored. And the truth of the matter is, I wasn't.
Walking back to our hotel last night, we came across people shooting up, just standing right on the sidewalk in front of you. So there's some areas for improvement.
But while the Minneapolis panel talked about their strategies,
this doesn't really identify Seattle's problem.
Business owner Ty Myers said the difference here in Seattle is too few police officers and a lack of law enforcement support from city leaders.
We've been nice to criminals. We've been nice to people that we probably shouldn't have been nice to. We've done that for now 7 years. This is what it's gotten us. It is now time to give the law enforcement back the stick.
All right. So I saw that and I thought, well, let's see how they're doing in Minneapolis.
Yeah. You, after all, you're all about context, John.
I just figured they'd, you know, you could just type in Minneapolis succeeds in crime wave.
Right.
And they are succeeding in the crime wave. They have quite the wave going on. And I'm like, that would be like the Mariners going to another city. Here's how you win.
Here's how you pay professional baseball.
Crime Index. This is from the neighborhoodscout.com. You can put that in there and you can put every city in and they give you all the breakdown of everything from violent crimes to crime rate and everything else. They do from 1 to 100, 100 being the safest city.
Okay.
Minneapolis gets a 3.
No.
Yeah. And then they have 50% increase in crimes and robberies. And what they've found is that what's been happening recently, big gang of kids goes around, finds somebody, beats the hell out of them, kicks them, jumps on top of them, rides a bike on top. They've got video of all this stuff. And they steal the guy's cell phone. They take the cell phone, they stick it into this new kiosk that then kicks out a couple $100 or $50 or something. Yeah. Have you seen these kiosks?
I know I haven't, actually, but apparently they're all around.
And then they get $200 for a stolen phone. And they're like, well, how can we stop this? Oh, I got an idea. Maybe stop the kiosk from kicking out money for stolen phones. But the crime rate in Minneapolis is like nutty compared to Seattle. When it comes to robberies and homicides, it's like, didn't anybody vet these guys before they showed up? Couldn't they have Google-aided them?
Yeah, you'd think. Now, the one thing, at least in the Gary Horker story, they do say that it reduced repeat criminal offenses by 75%.
Okay.
So maybe they're specifically looking at repeat criminal offenders, although offenses. Although, if you'd say that crime, you know, is not down. In other words, they stopped the repeat offenders, but
they got new ones coming in.
I'm not sure that's much of a.
Well, okay, all right. So if you're an expert in that field, which is, you know, then the repeat offenders, you know, we'll talk to you. Some other city comes in and talks to you about what to do about new offenders.
Murders.
Right.
And
we got the repeat. So I guess they support the idea. They said, first of all, you do have to stop the drug dealing, right? Because they say that's what they've done. They go in there. They don't let these people deal openly, publicly. Maybe they do it somewhere else.
Maybe, although the thrust of Horker's column, at least in the written part of it, the plan, which they claim improved public safety dramatically, is a partnership between police, probation officers, prosecutors, and social workers with financial support from the Minneapolis businesses. Mm-hmm. So they say they have outreach, they have really strong outreach from social workers and probation officers to prevent offenders from becoming frequent violent offenders, and they give them a choice between drug counseling and jail. Well, that sounds a lot like what we're already doing with mm-hmm. our LEAD program and kind of the whole, you know, the navigation team's approach. Yeah. So I don't know what is so revolutionary about what Minneapolis is exactly doing. Maybe they're ahead of us, you know, on that score or do more of it. But at least that seems to be, you know, something that we're all working on together.
September 13th, 2019, how safe is downtown Minneapolis? Police stats validate perception of rising crime. Police officer said crime statistics back up the view that safety is deteriorating in the city's business center. So it's in Precinct 1, they call it. They're looking at this one near near the theater department where all the theaters are and everybody goes downtown. They said just a rise in crime happening there.
Yeah, and that's what they cite, the downtown area. But that was 3 weeks ago, John, so things might have changed a
lot. You know how it goes.
Yeah. You know, a crime wave, it rolls
I'm sorry.
And then it rolls out.
Sorry, 3 weeks is old news. You're absolutely right. They find it interesting that the open-air drug dealing.
Yeah.
The police don't do anything about it, so it keeps going, right?
If they don't,
The reason they're drug dealing is because somebody wants to buy the drugs, right? So if there's a market for the drugs, there's going to be a drug dealer selling you the drugs. So then the guy steals stuff out of your car or hits you over the head with something and steals your wallet.
We'll get you.
What's that?
That's when we'll arrest you.
Oh, really?
If you steal something out of a car,
Tom. Well, they don't arrest you for that.
Well, they do if they see it in progress. In other words, what you're saying is they don't do anything. No,
it's a cycle.
The drug dealing is like it's all this, you know, semi surreptitious. You slip money and just like they don't interrupt that, but they probably if they see somebody breaking into a car, they would.
Oh, if you see a crime progress.
Yes, in other words. It's not open air robbery. So they catch you at the point where you're getting the product to get money for, not the actual drugs, perhaps.
Right, but I mean, such a simple, stupid cycle. Here's a drug addict. He needs money, so he steals from you. Then he takes the thing he stole from you, and then somebody converts that into cash. Then he walks over into Third and Pine, and he hands the guy the cash, and the guy hands him the drug. That's the end of it. That's the cycle, right? Somebody's thirsty for a beer. They go into a bar. They get a beer. They give the money. The same sort of thing. So here we are. They're going to go in and steal. So the problem is what? Is the problem that somebody leaves their backpack in their car? Stop leaving your backpack in the car. Is that the problem? Is the problem that the drug dealer's on the corner? No, the problem is the drug addict, right? If you solve that problem, you solve all the other problems, correct? The drug dealer goes away because there's no one to buy the drugs. The guy's backpack doesn't get stolen out of the car because there's no drug addict. So that's the beginning of the problem. That's where you need to put all the attention.
But the problem is that makes police work a little too simplistic because, after all, you can break down. I remember right where they mentioned Third and Pine and Third and Pine between Third and Union and Third and Pine. And they did that big sweep, and all it does is it's not like the demand goes away is the problem. It just goes to three blocks away.
Right. That's because they're getting the wrong part of it. So there's three parts to it. The one guy telling you don't leave your backpack in the car or don't park here. That's not it. You don't want to do that. It's not the drug dealer. If you get rid of the addict, you have to take the addict and do something about the addict himself, herself.
And that's sort of what LEAD, the whole diversion project, is. And that's sort of what Minneapolis is doing to not lower their crime rate in downtown Minneapolis.
Can you believe that they would let you have a kiosk? Baltimore got rid of them. These things came out in 2013. I think they might still be here in Seattle. I haven't seen them anywhere.
Yeah.
But Baltimore said immediately, they got them in place, they put them in there, you could put old electronics, and it was being sold as, it's a green thing, and then you can convert your old phone, and we'll give you cash for it. Baltimore, after a couple of weeks, that's not working for us.
Yeah.
And they got rid of them.
Because it encourages people to steal people's phones and get immediate cash. I can't believe these things dispense $250 in cash.
Check, are there any around here? I looked it up. There were some of them or something. Yeah. Hold on, Andrew.
No, go ahead, Jacob.
Go ahead. And one of you, just jump in and make the show even better.
At my community college, they had one where you just put it in for nothing. You just recycled it.
Yeah. Now, that's good
there
for
you
your community college.
Were there lines around the machine?
No, I never saw anyone use it.
It was actually known as a garbage can.
Yeah.
Okay. Jacob, is it still around?
I'm looking up. I don't, not to my knowledge. I've never seen one in Seattle.
Yeah, I know.
All right. Okay,
crazy.
Good. There we go. Let's see. Bolton was being described by, or Bolton described Rudy Giuliani.
This is he has a way with words. I'll give him that.
I've always liked John Bolton.
Yeah. Well, you know what's funny? Right now, liberals are thinking, "Hey,
this guy
might be an ace in the hole for us."
It was John Bolton that stood in the White House in July and said, "Listen, don't have a meeting. Don't have a meeting with terrorists. Don't fly them into the United States. Don't sit there at Camp David. This looks really, really, really bad." And he pushed back hard on Trump. Yeah. I think Trump kind of liked the fact that he thought, oh, he's a hawk. He's a hawk, hawk, hawk all the way through. But there's some nuance to Bolton. Bolton sees that some things just can't be done. And that's when they said that was really the beginning of the big split that caused him to get into a huge fight with a whole bunch of people. And then he finds, you know, I don't need this anymore. Right?
Yeah. Think of it as, in fact, the reason we're getting this information is because Dr. Fiona Hill, was the Soviet expert for the Trump administration and worked closely with Bolton, and she's considered a Russia hawk. Well, who are Russian hawks? They're people that don't trust Putin, you know, as far as they could throw him, and we have a president who likes to embrace Putin, and so there's this natural conflict. Well, what is Trump doing in Ukraine? What he's doing in Ukraine is actually catering to what the Russian theory is about the world, that it is Ukrainians that influenced the election, not the Russians.
Yeah.
And Bolton and Fiona Hill wanted nothing of it, and he was outraged that, as I mean, just in terms of the language, I'm not part of whatever drug deals Sondland and Mulvaney are cooking up. Sondland is the Mercer Island man who was the ambassador to the EU, who was getting involved with the Ukrainian business. And Mulvaney is the acting chief of staff for Donald Trump. And they were working this side deal with the Ukraine outside regular foreign policy decisions with Giuliani. And Bolton was saying, listen, do not get involved with this. Giuliani, and this is a quote, Giuliani's a hand grenade who's going to blow everybody up, which is indeed what seems to be. We're in the midst of a slow motion hand grenade explosion with the arrest of his two aides the other day and all. And so, this is now, there was a split between Bolton and Pompeo and Trump and Giuliani and Mick Mulvaney. And now that Bolton's been ousted, he's sort of, you know, getting back by saying, listen, I told him not
to deal with this. Was he ousted or he left? Well, remember that he tweeted out, the president said that he got rid of him. I think Bolton sent out earlier that he resigned.
That's right. Well, it's the
same thing.
Yeah, in effect, it's the same thing. And so right now he's saying, I told him not to take that. Don't do that stupid phone call and don't offer that to Ukrainians.
So we have Democrats running these running this investigation privately. They get a chance. She testified for 10 hours, and then the Democrats get a chance to leak out what they'd like to leak out from the meetings. Of the 10 hours, it's boiled down to a couple of sound bites in order to be able to control the narrative of this story, as opposed to actually having a vote and making these things public and then allowing everybody to hear the witnesses. You've got controlled release of information as they are running the new show, the new Watergate Ukraine-gate against Donald Trump to get him out of there. So Representative Denny Heck offers his perspective on Ms. Hill.
As we've indicated with prior witnesses, I will give you my impression of Dr. Hill, however. I've been in Congress 7 years, and I can say in all candor that after thousands of hours of hearings, I've never had a witness that came across as substantive per minute as she did. There was an amazing amount of information provided, and I think it will be very helpful. Number two, if the woman doesn't have an eidetic memory, a total recall, then she's close to it. And thirdly, she had every bit as much energy in the ninth hour of her testifying today as she did in the first minute.
There you go.
Okay, so no
a review
there
of her as an individual.
Yes,
nothing she
right.
said.
Yeah.
How about Jim Jordan?
We're not supposed to talk about the substance of anything said in the room, not supposed to characterize the testimony in any way. That's just the rules, and unfortunately, they're not going to follow them, but we feel like we have to if those are the rules. We'd like the parliamentarian, as Lee said, to give us a ruling on how this whole thing is supposed to work. We don't know that. Like I said, Mr. Schiff was even trying to say that minority couldn't ask questions for the full length of time. The back and forth that goes hour each side, which is just ridiculous. But that just shows you how ridiculous this entire process is.
Okay. And then Trump tweeted on multiple segments on Mark Levin's show yesterday. Oh, boy.
In past impeachments involving inquiries into presidents, it was a civil process.
a rational process, a process that was actually bipartisan, that involved both political parties.
Okay, we're going to listen to Mark Levin?
No, this is just what, I mean, we don't have to.
It's the only reason it's even referenced is because the president tweeted him out, but it just shows you.
Depositions and so forth. The goal was to get as much of the body politic involved as possible. This is the first time in American history that we have a rogue Speaker of the House and a small majority Democrat party in the House of Representatives that's trying to drag our country in a different direction.
Okay, there we go. Okay. How about Nadler? He's got to feel pretty bad.
That he is now...
been replaced. Nancy looked at it and said, Nadler, you're doing a crappy job. Let's get Adam back in there. That was his whole thing. Nadler is got a very, very difficult reelection campaign coming up. He's got a young progressive individual running against him, and they wanted Nadler to show some strength in there and to be able to go against, you know, look, like we're going after Trump, we're going to go get Trump. But apparently he didn't do enough, didn't have enough people on board, so they took that away from him. I still think he probably ends up winning, although he looks like he's going to run for his life.
We'll see. I don't know enough about the internal politics there in his district, but I do think in this situation here, the Ukraine phone call changed the impeachment proceedings. Nadler was sort of running things from his committee, but once it became an international thing, then I think the Intelligence Committee took over, and so it allowed Nancy Pelosi to shift the focus I don't think that Nadler would have lost his standing if the Ukrainian business hadn't come along.
Nadler was the one that was still sifting through the nonsense of the Mueller investigation after Mr. Mueller's 7 hours of stumbling around, not remembering even where he was. It was Nadler that had that circus going, and I guess that circus has left the town now. Now Adam Schiff is in charge.
I mean, there are a lot of, as you call them, circuses going on, because after all, the president's involved in lots of circuses.
Right.
The thing is right now, the newest circus, the one that finally got the hesitant Nancy Pelosi on board, was the Ukrainian business, and that's why Schiff's
she made that, but isn't it weird she made that statement before they released the transcripts?
I don't know what you're talking about.
She announced it on Tuesday. The transcripts came out the next day, but she announced that we're going to investigate and we're going to start impeachment inquiry. But then she read the transcripts.
Yes, because the word came out about what the transcript had said.
Right.
And then we had confirmation because a whistleblower complaint already existed.
Well, you don't actually see the quid pro quo in that one. By the way, just heard this from Wayne. He says there is a kiosk that gives money for phones. It's at Northgate Mall, food court.
We also had some people in Federal Way saying that they've seen them in Rensselaer.
There you go.
Is that right? Okay.
Well, don't forget, it was Andrew, the first one to break the news.
That you can do it for free.
That's right.
That's right. If you want, feel better about it. The problem is nobody. I just recently went to Northgate. There's hardly anybody there now.
Hey, Tom, that's another story. Neil Mortgage, Laura Keel. Do me a favor, Andrew, during this brief moment, would you call Keel Mortgage and ask what color Laura's hair is for me?
All right, what's the number?
1-888-778-KIEL. That's right, Keel Mortgage.
Identify yourself as John Curley when you make the call.
Yes, you'll get special service. All right. If you want a mortgage or anything having to do with a mortgage, seconds, maybe you want to find out about whether or not a reverse mortgage is right for you. It's Keel Mortgage. Best place to call, 1-888-778-KIEL. Okay. I always like to have a visual image of the stuff that I'm talking about, and Laura's hair helps.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
All right. You want to start with the first one and then do the second one in the order that they have appeared?
Let's go for it.
All right, here we go. Why crying employees can sometimes be a sign of a healthy workplace. Fascinating article.
Yes.
Yeah, I like the fact that it begins with a woman is having some problems because she's taking some different birth control. Mm-hmm. So her hormones are all over the place. She runs into some stress in the workplace and she quietly begins to cry. She looks down at her computer and then two letters pop up on the screen sent to her from another fellow employee somewhere else. And what were those letters, Tom?
I never realized the potency of those two letters.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
And she burst into tears,
yes.
Left a meeting so no one would see her as she raced down a flight of stairs to some quiet place where she could cry. And she said, what am I doing? Tears just show that I'm human.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, tears are one of the most human things humans do.
Yeah.
So why are we so embarrassed at work, especially that to show our humanity in the face of other people? Uh-huh. And then she says, with good reason. And that good reason is what? People think that people who cry are, quote, less competent.
Huh.
And that is the social stigma that we have attached to crying ever since whenever. I don't know, and I don't know if this is deep, a deep kind of evolutionary instinct, right, or if it's a recent cultural thing, but that is the reason that people kind of want to hide the fact that they can get emotional.
Well,
and show
what we need to do is have less competent people crying. The that's the problem.
Yes.
It's like, oh, there's causation, right? But you look at it and you go, okay, that person's incompetent and they cry a lot. So then you associate the two. But I have seen people, I've been to a lot of these events and stuff. I was at one the other day. This guy's halfway through the speech. He starts to cry. I always thought the weirdest part of that is, so it's a guy starts to cry.
Yeah.
And then people in the back go, yeah, you got this. It's like, what is he, bench pressing or is he crying? And he's trying to get control. Come on, man. You
power
got it.
Through
you
the
got
tears.
It, man. Come on. And then everybody starts to applaud.
Yeah.
And then he kind of chokes back the tears. And then he's being encouraged to sort of keep, don't cry.
Yeah, don't cry.
Get back going.
Yes. Whereas you would like to say, bring those tears on, yes, baby. Let them flow. Let them flow.
That's right.
Well, this article, oddly, I think, associates the reason why it's condemned in the workplace, or at least discouraged in the workplace, is that people associate tears with negative emotions, and those negative emotions are stigmatized because they see this as a flawed personality, that you are somehow not a happy worker, but a sad worker, and happy workers are cheaper workers, and we all need to kind of throw off this mantle of everybody has to be upbeat and happy at work in order to be have it to be a productive place. His argument is sad is good. In fact, he argues that sad or negative people actually do better in the job than happy people because they're more observant, because they're more critical and all this. Now, I don't buy that connection that sadness equals a negative emotion. I don't think that you're sad or you're critiquing work. Something has upset you personally, and it could be in your personal life and doesn't mean anything, you know, in the workplace. It could mean that somebody's being bullied at work, and that's something that needs to be addressed. But this idea that somehow sad is negative and
okay, let's say we're at work, right?
Yes.
And you see two people sitting there. Let's say it's a woman that's crying about the fact that she didn't get a good review or she lost an account or whatever. But then you see a guy sitting over at his desk crying.
Yeah.
You give more weight to the guy's tears than the woman's tears.
That's
don't
right.
You?
One yes. of the one of the things this article also looks at is says this is really bad news if crying at work is stigmatized because more women tend to cry than men, and they say why is that? And some actually I've never heard this. The shape of the eyes for women make it easier for them to cry. That's one sort of a physiological explanation.
Huh.
Another is that it's societally kind of conditioned to women are the criers and men aren't.
Uh-huh.
And so when you see a man crying, it's more exceptional, you know, stands out more than when a woman does. But the important thing, I think, the thrust of this article is that if someone is crying at work, you shouldn't immediately think, "Wow, that person's weak."
No.
Because a lot of the weakness of men is that they deny their emotions and so they repress them. Because he says, when you repress your need to cry, when you repress your emotions, that actually wears you out more and you makes you a less effective, makes you a sicker employee, a less effective employee. Somebody may end up having a heart attack because of all that repression.
Yeah.
But we need to be able to have a workplace where we embrace it, we acknowledge it. And they go through three steps. First, validate the person rather than kind of trying to talk them out of feeling sad. Ask open-ended questions. And finally say, okay, what can we do about it to change the matter?
When we went to do this story, Jacob pitched it with, this does not pertain to you two because you cry on the air all the time.
That's right. That's a different kind of.
I wrote a letter to my mom.
Oh, you did? Okay.
And I,
and
in
we're
the final
not gonna cry,
minute, I'm
going to
make it all the way through.
Okay.
Actually,
hey, you can do it, John. You can get through it.
Right. This is not to my mom. This is my brother, my sister, and I all writing stuff for the funeral.
Yes.
All right?
Your mother has not died.
She has not. She's laying there, and Chuck says it's close.
Yeah.
My brother just texted me, Mom's on the 18th hole right now. It says, all right, it was a late summer evening, and the faint smell of DDT sweetened the still and now mosquito-less air.
Already you got a joke in there.
They used to spray DDT in our neighborhood.
Sure.
Okay. Mom and I were walking Mandy, our dachshund. We had made it to the end of the road, at least to some arbitrary turning around point that my mom had chosen, like the hydrant, the stop sign, the neighbor's mailbox, would forever be the designated turnaround spot. While heading back home, Mandy stopped to deposit a small package on the neighbor's yard. It was a different time. You could do this. My mom didn't seem to care very much about Mandy doing her business on the well-manicured green lawn. She was more concerned with the neighbors would think of Mandy's diet, which normally consisted of some dog food, torn up old tissues, and a balloon or two. Mom said, "What are they going to think of us? What are they going to think we feed our dog?" As we continued our walk back, she stopped at one point to ask me what life was like down there. I looked at her. She repeated the question, and she bent down beside me. She put her cheek against my cheek. She said, "I want to see what you see." And with that, she pointed straight ahead. "You see the tree? You see our driveway?" I said, "Yes." She turned her head slightly to the right. "And that tree over there, and you can see the shutters on that house?" I said, "Yes, I can." We turned back, straight ahead now, and she gave a small jerk to the leash, and Mandy began to walk. She stood back up again. She looked at me, and she said, "I just wanted to see what life was like for you down there." This is the first time in my life I think I'd ever felt as if I'd mattered.
Come on, Judd! You can do it! Suck it up, man!
No matter how small I was, that my feelings mattered. My memory of a walk with Mom.
There you go.
I got only two. Because I blew right through it as fast as I possibly could.
Yes.
You're supposed to type right now on my computer, Tom. Okay? Question mark.
Yes, that's right.
By the way, Laura Keel's hair is what color?
Pink and purple.
Pink and purple. Not very Seahawk-y.
By the way, why is CenturyLink Field lit up those colors? The exact same colors, pink and purple.
Ah.
I smell a conspiracy.
You sure that's what you smell in there?
It might be something else. I'll
be right back. All right, for those people that are into running, this is the big talk of the town, is the fact that they wanted to know, could a human being break the two-hour time of running a marathon, 26.2 miles, which means the body has to move at 4 minutes and 30 seconds or 35 seconds a mile, which basically for most people, they would never be able to accomplish at that speed for 200 yards. These guys are running like a sprint. Remember that?
Yeah.
Sprinting. You're sprinting for 26.2 miles. So this guy does it, and he speaks about after the marathon. Rye watched the video. He said what he was most amazed by, after he had finished, he jumped up in the air and grabbed his flag. He's dancing around like it was nothing.
"I'm the happiest man to run under 2 hours in order to inspire many people, to tell people that no human is limited. You can do it. I'm expecting more of the athletes in this all over the world to run under 2 hours after today."
Okay, well, it's going to be a little harder to run under 2 hours for most people because he did get some advantages that now some people are pointing out. Well, this doesn't really count.
Okay, well, and it's not officially a world record because it wasn't under race time conditions.
Right. Yes.
This was a one-off by an individual who had an entire support team.
Nike worked on this whole thing.
Yes,
right? Yeah.
Absolutely. And Ineos, I think, is this big chemical producer in the United Kingdom, which bankrolled the winning Tour de France team, so they're now getting into sports sponsorship, and they paid for this. And how did he do it? And I have no problem with this. It's not competitive. It's just it's a test of human endurance.
Yeah.
First off, this stuff I find fascinating. There was a pace car, and what the pace car did is it had a laser beam, and it would show him you follow this laser beam path, and that is the absolute shortest distance between the beginning and the end. Because they say most runners, they wobble side to side. And he says, no, you just got to stay on the straight line.
Yeah.
Then second, they had this, as they call them, pace-setting runners known as rabbits, about 50 of them that would rotate. They would run to keep him at a certain pace. They all ran ahead of him to break the wind.
They ran in a V like geese do.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, and similar again to the to Tour de France. And they say, and these weren't just regular runners who said, hey, I'll volunteer to do this. These were like world-class medal-winning runners to keep up that pace because they said, even if 5 seconds, if you're 5 seconds off, over 26 miles, 5 seconds a mile really kills you.
Yeah.
And then he also had what they say are performance-enhancing Nike racing shoes. Now, the idea here is that that's the least controversial because there are always products being designed. That's the least controversial. But they said without all of that, and again, they chose the shortest flattest arena and all this. There were no weather conditions that were negative. And under those conditions, this guy's already the greatest. He's he already has the world record just over 2 hours, and he's the 2016 Olympic gold medalist.
But don't take it away from him. Don't to do this. The guy ran 4 hours and 30 or 4 minutes and 30 some seconds per mile.
Per mile.
Right. And he was able to bust it. So he's under 2 hours.
Which just shows you that the human body can withstand that. Now, most of us couldn't, but he can. And if he can, maybe the next guy
saying that hopefully this inspires other people. Nope. I'm sorry.
Oh, you don't? No.
No, because it's so superhuman that you would never be able to do that. I remember one time we had an astronaut come and speak at our school, our high school. And I'm just sitting there watching this guy. Oh, yeah, okay, he's an astronaut. And he's trying to inspire us with what he did. I'm thinking, I'll never do that. I will never do that. I'll never be an astronaut. I'm not going into outer space. So all of his sort of thing of like, look at me, look where I am, look what I was able to achieve. It didn't inspire me. It just made me go, okay, well, good for you. Like, look at this guy. I'll never be able to run that. Most people can never run that. He's a genetic freak. He has probably mostly slow twitch muscle. And he's everybody there in this town that he lives in. Apparently, it's just like super duper fast. But it doesn't inspire some if he can do it. Let me see some great big fat guy that lost like 600 pounds. Let me see him finish an Ironman and be like, well, that person do it. I could do it. That's more like it.
Well, the idea is so then you are turned off. If LeBron James came to your school, you would not be inspired by him.
I love LeBron James, but I wouldn't be like, someday I'm going to be like LeBron James.
But one could argue that LeBron James is LeBron James because Michael Jordan inspired him. It all depends on the level at which you want to be inspired. You'd be inspired by Homer Simpson. Hey,
who?
Look at that guy. He got a job.